From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, poet Jane Shore. Her poems evoke an era through its details. She grew up in New Jersey in the 50s and 60s and can perfectly capture the period by describing a bathing cap, a bargain underwear bin, or her parents' dress shop. Her collection, Music Minus One, is out in paperback. Danny Aiello is starring in a new TV series called Della Ventura that premieres next week. From our archives, we'll feature an interview about Aiello's life before he started acting in his mid-30s. And rock historian Ed Ward reviews a new collection of previously unreleased Elvis recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. A military hearing officer has recommended Sergeant Major of the Army Gene McKinney should face court-martial after reviewing allegations by six women who said he made improper advances toward them. In the report he submitted today, Colonel Robert Jarvis rejected a request by the chief prosecutor to add rape to the list of charges against McKinney. The report recommends McKinney be charged with 22 counts of sexual misconduct. A French judge has questioned the sole survivor of the Paris car crash that claimed the life of Princess Diana, Dodi Al-Fayed, and their driver. But officials say Diana's bodyguard is unable to provide details of the fatal accident. From Paris, the BBC's Hugh Schofield reports.
The judge, Hervé Stéphane, spent half an hour with Trevor Rees-Jones. Also in the hospital room were his parents, a doctor, a senior police officer, and a translator. Officials close to the investigation said the bodyguard is suffering from partial amnesia. He was able to respond to some of the judge's questions, but he had gaps in his memory, and he was unclear on some aspects of the accident. Mr. Rees-Jones will be interviewed again, probably in the coming days, but as things stand, it seems unlikely he'll cast much light on any of the key questions. How close, for example, were the photographers at the time of the crash? Was there a mysterious second car? Above all, perhaps, what were the actions of the driver, Henri Paul, in the hours before he took the wheel?
The BBC's Hugh Schofield. Governors from six mid-Atlantic states are meeting in Annapolis, Maryland, to discuss the microbe Fisteria that's killing fish from Maryland to North Carolina. Kevin Mershard of member station WSCL reports.
Maryland Governor Paris Glendening closed parts of three tributaries to the Chesapeake Bay after people reported health problems when they came into contact with water where the toxic form of Fisteria was detected. But Virginia Governor George Allen says more evidence is needed to link the microbe to people before he'll take such action. Doctors in Maryland say they have that evidence. Governor Allen is attending the meeting along with the governors of Delaware and West Virginia. Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and the Environmental Protection Agency will also be represented. The governors will be briefed by doctors from the University of Maryland who believe they found the link between Fisteria and a syndrome characterized by chronic difficulties with learning and memory. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Mershart in Salisbury, Maryland.
A United Nations human rights envoy travels to the United States this weekend to investigate capital punishment and possible deaths due to excessive force by law enforcement officials. Barswale Ndiaye's mission follows the execution in Virginia Wednesday of a 25-year-old Mexican convicted in a murder-for-hire killing of a Navy cook despite a plea for clemency by the Mexican government. Last year, the International Commission of Jurists accused the United States of carrying out death sentences that were arbitrary and racially discriminatory against blacks. You're listening to National Public Radio News. The stock market is mixed. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
There have been several warnings that corporate performance will not meet expectations. Union Carbide cautioned that earnings will fall short of estimates, while Nike and Rubbermaid said that sales will be disappointing. On the other hand, computer-related issues are benefiting from better-than-expected earnings at Adobe Systems. And Gillette is higher after the company said it would buy back more than 4% of its common stock. Overall, the market is being buffeted by various trading strategies associated with today's expiration of options and futures contracts. I'm Doug Krisner.
The Vatican today called on the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and wealthy nations to act quickly to apply debt reduction for developing countries. The Vatican's Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace made the appeal in a statement to coincide with a meeting in Hong Kong of the two institutions. The statement says the poor pay the biggest price for indecision and delay. The IMF and the World Bank have a joint initiative to help heavily indebted poor countries. The World Trade Organization said today the cause may be the cure for Asia's current economic crisis. The WTO says Asian nations may be able to trade their way out of the current troubles, but warned that further market liberalization is crucial to Asia's recovery. Some experts say Asia's economic problems were brought on by a combination of a slowdown in exports and a rapid influx of capital. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 41 points at 78.86.9 on volume of 318 million shares. The Nasdaq index is up fractionally at 16.70. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The first thing that attracted me to Jane Shore's poems was the title of her book, Music Minus One. It's named after those recordings musicians can practice with, records with arrangements that leave a space for your instrument. Turns out the title poem is about her father, who gave up his career performing with big bands to help raise the family. The intriguing title led me to lots of poems I enjoyed. Music Minus One has just come out in paperback. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with Jane Shore recorded last spring. The poems in the book are very autobiographical, about growing up in a Jewish family in the 50s and 60s. She lived upstairs from her parents' dress shop in New Jersey. With subjects like vacationing in the Catskills, shopping for bargain underwear in the 5 and 10, shaving your legs, and playing dead, these poems are about the details that form you. The book was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. Jane Shore teaches creative writing at George Washington University and lives in Washington, D.C. and Vermont. I spoke with her last spring and asked her to read an excerpt of her poem, Heat Wave, Cold War.
I wheeled my baby sister to the park. The baseball diamond deserted, a dusty, wavering mirage. It was hot. So hot, the Chamber of Commerce canceled the annual chicken barbecue, the coals already burning under the empty grills. My father closed up early. We lounged around all afternoon in our apartment over the store. My mother wore her sheerest bra and panties. My father stripped to his boxer shorts. He sat at the kitchen table in the path of the fan, like a game of solitaire, the ticket stubs, the week's receipts before him. I was cutting out a family of paper dolls, wool winter coats and hats, the daughter's organdy party dress. My elbow stuck to the vinyl tablecloth, my thighs to the vinyl cushions. I was wearing the thick cotton underpants I'd worn throughout my childhood, my chest bare in front of my father for the very last time. The Cold War was on TV. My scissors cut along the shoulders, hips, the perfect neutral bodies. The father didn't have my father's bald spot, nor the mother my mother's belly. Their modest children, a girl and a boy, had underwear painted onto their skin. I cut out their split-level house in the country, their collie, their crew-cut lawn. I cut out their flagstone patio, shady backyard. The kit even had a fallout shelter with walls of painted shelves filled with canned goods and bottled water. Too hot to talk, too hot to eat, we lowered the blinds and sat in the dark all day and evening. Turning on lamps only made more heat. We camped out on the living room sofa, Ozzie and Harriet, canned laughter, the news. The station signed off. Jets flew in formation to the strains of the national anthem. When the peacock's tail feathers fanned out, an array of grays, my father flicked the dial. We watched a white dot fade and shrink to nothing in the center of the blackened screen. Finally, we all tried to sleep. My mother lay down in the twin bed across from mine, on top of her separate sheet, dabbing her forehead with a cold washcloth. During the night, the fever broke. Only juice for breakfast. At 10 a.m., in shorts and a halter, I went downstairs with my father. He unlocked the store. 30 seconds to turn off the alarm. Inside smelled stuffy, like a closet. He got the big ceiling fan going. Cooling air rustled through the dress racks. I had left my mother working at the kitchen table, pasting up the ad for Sunday's paper, snipping and gluing the cutout models on the page under Corduroy Village Summer Sale, 20% off. While my father dusted the counter, I modeled jewelry for no one. The first customer walked in about 11. Formal to the end, under his suit jacket, my father wore a short-sleeved shirt and kept his tie tied until closing.
Jane Shore, I think one of the things that I like so much about your poems is your sense of detail and the triggers that some of those details set off in me. I think some of your poems just set off these, like, sense memory reactions. And I'm wondering if you always gravitated toward the details of your memories and of day-to-day life.
When I was growing up, one of the things I loved to do was paint. I was very interested in the visual world, painting, and because my parents had a store and because there were clothes in the store, women's clothes, I was always very interested in the specific details of what I saw before me. But I think I always went for the visual rather than the oral. I always felt that I loved seeing things. I love seeing the things around me, and I love seeing stuff in the world, the things of the world, just walking around and looking around.
Let me read a couple of lines that are, again, kind of the details of life that, for me, evoke real sense memories. I snapped my rubber bathing cap under my chin, tucking in my ponytail, and inched down the ladder into the pool, aquamarine as the birthstone ring I'd left in our hotel room for safekeeping. I remember the bathing cap. I had the ponytail. I sometimes got into pools in the summer. I remember when every girl I knew had a birthstone ring, the amethyst or the turquoise, whatever the other stones
yes.
were. I guess these were the details of life. I always figured one had to leave to become a poet. You had to kind of give up this boring world of the rubber bathing cap and find a much more interesting world to write about if you were going to write poetry.
Yes, that's what my teachers told me that. They said that poems had to be about life, death, love, beauty, and nature. And that's what poems were about. And it struck me that in my life, filled with bathing caps and bras and...
right, which you also write about.
that it was certainly far from beauty and certainly not about life and death at all. So, but the older I get, I find the more I return to those things of those specific things of childhood, those specific objects, which I just can't let them go. It's like going into an antique store and something calls you to
yes,
them.
Yes, exactly. That's funny because I think you just described exactly the feeling I have from some of your poems. Did you ever try to write poems with more exalted subject matter?
Well, I hope that even though the poems... You mean sitting down to be profound.
Exactly. Like reaching for those big subjects, the life, the death. I mean, your poems are about life and death, but actually literally writing about them in a more literal way.
When I was 14 and 15, I wrote a lot of poems about life. And I wrote poems about the womb of oblivion. That was my big
yes.
line. Or the kaleidoscope of life. And it turns out that that's what my students write about, too, mm-hmm. although they're not 14 and 15. They're a little bit older than that. But I think that's where everybody starts. And I actually think I set out to write poems that I felt were about profound subjects so I could baffle my parents so that they wouldn't understand what it was I was writing about. And I think I'm not that kind of poet. I really feel I don't get the kind of pleasure. I don't know. I think when I was starting to write and as I began writing more, I guess I didn't feel like I had any really big ideas. And that if you were going to write about the smaller things or the things that appeared to be uninteresting except to yourself, that if the poem was really going to work the way it should work, it would somehow touch on the larger things. But if I sit down and say, now I'm going to write a poem about life, I just can't do it. But if I say, now I'm going to write a poem about a Mahjong bracelet I have or a Mahjong set I have, Very quickly, I can find, once I start exploring what that object is or that game is, I can start finding deeper things, although I don't consciously know it when I sit down to write it.
My guest is Jane Shore, and her latest book of poems is called Music Minus One. There's another poem I'd like you to read from the book, and it's the poem called Workout. Before you read it, would you tell us what inspired the poem?
I have a sister who's 8 years younger than I am, and she, I think, had to really follow in my footsteps in a lot of ways. And it's about, I guess it's my sibling rivalry poem. It's about growing older and feeling that who has the advantage, perhaps, feeling the kind of burden of being the older sister. Also, I know there's a burden of being a younger sister. And also, everyone says that the older sister is the one who's the nice, well-behaved girl, and the younger sister is the one who's the rebel. And so I guess both sisters have their burdens to carry. But my sister is a folk singer also, and she sings country and western and folk. And I think she inherited the musical talent in my family. And this is a poem about that, about feeling that one passes through stages of life. It's about rivalry. It's about wanting to not have a sister, I think, at times. Although now I'm very happy I have a sister. Workout. My sister is doing her exercises, working out in my husband's study. The rowing machine sighs deeply with every stroke, its heavy breathing like a couple making love. She's visiting from Iowa, where the cold weather is much worse. When she was 10, I'd hear her strumming her guitar through the bedroom wall. She'd borrow my albums, my Joan Baez, my Dylan, and sing along, shutting me out, drawing me in, imitating my hair, my clothes, my generation. I used to feel sorry for her for being 8 years younger. She opens the door a crack and surfaces in earphones and wearing pink bikini panties and a lover's torn T-shirt. Strapped to her hands are the weights that weighed her suitcase down. Her thighs are tight, her triceps shine, her body is her trophy. The night she arrived, we sprawled across my bed, her cosmetic bag spilled open, and she shadowed my eyelids violet, demonstrating the latest tricks, the way I used to make her up on those nights she watched me dress for dates, watched me slip into my miniskirt, my sandals, my love beads. Now she's no longer in love with me and eyes me pityingly, triumphant, her expression the same as mine when I watched my mother examine her face in the magnifying mirror. She's got to keep in shape. She's a performer. It's her business to look beautiful every night. Sometimes when she begins to sing, men in the audience fall in love. She's warming up in the shower. The tile walls amplify her voice, safe for once under temperate rain. Like a dress handed down from sister to sister, in time, one body will inherit what the other has outgrown.
Has your sister read the poem?
Yes. In fact, she said, when she read it, she said, well, it's the one poem that you wrote about me, and I don't love it, but, you know, it's the way you really felt. Yes, it is. It is. I guess I knew it when I was writing it, too. I'm 8 years older. I'm a lot of pounds heavier. It's about rivalry.
There's the line in the poem when you say that your sister's expression was the same as mine when I watched my mother examine her face in the magnifying mirror. What did you think about when you watched your mother examine her face in the magnifying mirror?
You don't want to think that you're actually going to be like that once yourself. And in fact, I'm working on a poem right now in which I've inherited my mother's magnifying mirror. And I don't like what I see. I mean, what I see is my mother's face. You look at yourself getting older, And you think, when you're a younger person, that'll never happen to me. And when I'm that age, I'm going to be really beautiful because I'm really going to take care of myself.
No, when I'm that age, I'm going to be really young.
That's right. I'm still going to look just the way I look when I'm 20. But in fact, it's absolutely true that you look at yourself and it magnifies who you are. It magnifies your faults and maybe your good things, too. But unfortunately, I look just like my mother now. And my sister knows that, so
she scores a point for that?
Well, you know, I realized also, I mean, at the end of the poem, it's a kind of curse. You know, one day you're going to get what I don't, you know, what I have now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a kind of curse. I guess that was my last, I had to get one last lick in. My sister was not thrilled with this poem.
My guest is poet Jane Shore. Her book is called Music Minus One. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with poet Jane Shore.
The title poem from your book, Music Minus One, is about your father.
Yes.
Who used to play with big bands, I guess, in the 30s and 40s. Played with Clyde McCoy. Did Clyde McCoy have the recording of Sugar Blues?
Yes, and this is an amazing thing that just happened. I was in San Francisco last week, and I was in a bookstore. And I was leaving the bookstore, and on the way out, I walked by the music aisle. And a title caught my eye, and it was the big band's Almanac. And I thought, well, hey, let me just take a look at this and see what's in there. So I looked up M, and I looked up Clyde McCoy, and there, the picture of Clyde McCoy's band was a picture of my father, taken in 1936, I think, when he must have been 21 years old, and there he is playing. And I almost died. It's the first time that my inside, what I felt was my personal inside history, suddenly was there. I was in the bookstore, and there was a picture of my father.
Now, your father had to give up music, I guess, to be home with the family, maybe, or?
Well, it was after, he had played before the war, then he had gone, he'd been a Marine in the war, and he'd play, I guess he'd led the Marine band. He played in the South Pacific, and when he came home, it was another world. He married my mother, and I was born a year later, and I think he felt that music was no life. For if you wanted to be a family man, you couldn't stay out all night playing music. You couldn't lead your wild, crazy life that you'd lived before. And he right away went to work in a music repair shop on the Lower East Side. He did that for a year or two. And then I think he was just really looking around to see what he could do. And my mother had been a saleswoman, I think at Bambergers or Stearns in Newark, selling cosmetics, and they decided to go into business. And in the beginning, he was just going to help her. And then as the years progressed, he got more and more involved in the business.
I'm wondering if when you started writing, you thought, well, I'm going to stick with it. My father had to give up playing professionally and ended up owning a store, but I'm going to stick with this writing thing.
I think that was the center of what I always felt the sadness that my father had. And even though I would say, Dad, you know, wouldn't you rather be playing now? Wouldn't you rather be in the band? Wouldn't you rather be on television with all your buddies that you see on Johnny Carson? And he'd say, no, I'm quite content. I can listen to my music. And because he had a tremendous collection of records. He'd listen to the radio day and night. But I never really believed him. Never. I thought, well, why would you want to give up that glamorous life for this? But in fact, I think that you're right. I think that if you have a commitment to something that you really, really love, and if it's possible to do it, and I think you make it possible to do, then you should do it. And with my father, I think there were circumstances. He was born, it was the Depression. People had a different mentality. They gave up a lot of things that I think I certainly nowadays probably would not give up.
I have one more question for you. You said before that you respond really well to encouragement. As a teacher, how do you handle encouragement and criticism?
I immediately, because I had wonderful teachers in college and graduate school, I think that a person does not do well when they're yelled at or when they're made fools of. I feel that if you write a poem and there's one terrific line in it or one image in it, you should know that you did that. And I believe that poetry and all art grows through nurture. And I try to treat my students the same way that my teachers treated me, which was really encouraging, really. But when you do something that's not so good, when you write a cliche, you have to be told also so that you won't keep making the same mistake. And also with my students, everybody has a very unique life. Each person has a unique life, and only they know what they can write about. And that's the thing I try to get to them. I think if you try to write about everything that you see around you that's not you, you won't get art, you won't get a good poem. But the more particular you get, the more specific you get in your life and in your art, I think that's when the really good work happens.
Well, Jane Shore, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Jane Shore's book, Music Minus One, has just been published in paperback by Picador. She teaches creative writing at George Washington University. Well, this is Sugar Blues, played by Clyde McCoy and his orchestra, the band her father played with. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you. up, actor Danny Aiello. He's starring in Della Ventura, a new TV series that begins next week. Also, rock historian Ed Ward reviews a new collection of Elvis outtakes and alternate takes, most of which have never been released before. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Danny Aiello is starring in a new TV series that premieres Tuesday on CBS. He plays a cop turned private eye. His son, Rick, co-stars. On this archive edition, we have a 1992 interview with Danny Aiello. Aiello is a great actor with no formal training, but he has plenty of what's called life experience. He used to work for Greyhound Bus and was the president of the union local. After a dispute with management, he was out of a job, and when he needed money real bad, he stole it. Then he worked as a bouncer at several clubs. He didn't start acting until his mid-30s. He got his breaks in the films Purple Rose of Cairo as Mia Farrow's husband, Moonstruck as Cher's intended, and Do the Right Thing as Sal, the owner of the pizzeria. I spoke with him after the release of his film Ruby, in which he played Jack Ruby, who shot Lee Harvey Oswald after Oswald was imprisoned for assassinating JFK. Aiello told me he remembers watching Ruby shoot Oswald live on TV.
I went, yip, yip, hooray. I believed at that time, Terry, in street justice, an eye for an eye. He killed our president, and this guy killed him. Good. That's how I felt. And this, of course, was the germ of the idea where I began to formulate the character of Ruby. I made him in my own mind a hero. And as we know, the way Ruby ends up, we find out that he's really not a hero, and he's realizing it toward the end of his life. But that was my reaction.
When did you stop thinking hip, hip, hooray?
Well, hip, because, you know, I still have a feeling about Ruby. I feel that he murdered this guy, but I truly feel that he was a victim as well of the kind of a person he was. He was a very ingratiating person. He was a chameleon kind of person. He was a person who brushed shoulders with many, many kinds of people. And whenever he did that, assuming that it was a wise guy, he would attempt to take on the persona of a wise guy. If he was on a stage introducing an act, he suddenly became Dale Carnegie with a southern twinge in his voice, therefore placating his audience. And if he was with an intellectual, he would become or attempt to become that kind of a person. He was a person that was looking for acceptance all of his life, I feel. And through my investigation of the character and a little that there was on Ruby, I formulated this kind of character, which I thought would be complex and very nice to do. He never left me. He has never left me. The word hero might not be the correct one, but he's never left me as a guy who did what he had to do. The reason, if I do call him a hero and feel that he was a hero, I don't know exactly when I stopped feeling that way. I don't know if I entirely have stopped feeling that way. But he was a guy who did something he felt, in my opinion, was patriotic. He did something which he felt was going to uplift his race of people, which are Jewish people. This is what I feel. He did something that he thought was heroic, only later to find out that people didn't think he was a hero. He thought they stole from the American people. He stole from the American people the opportunity of finding out what actually did happen. And as a result of that, they felt that he was a conspirator. And I think from that point on was when his downfall was, and he slowly died from then on.
You portray Ruby as a small-time guy who's gotten in over his head.
Absolutely.
And who often has to bluff his way out of tight situations. And you do wonderful line readings in the movie. I mean, I think you just convey a lot with your voice and with where you put the accents in certain readings of lines. I wonder how you rehearse these things, even at home. And I don't even necessarily mean on the set, but when you got this script and you were trying to figure out how you would do the character, how you would do specific lines, what's your process like for testing out your line reading?
I wish I had a process. I do it until I learn it, and I don't learn it. I'm talking about line by line by line. I don't memorize it to the extent where it's like rote. It's always got to be fresh and new to me. I like to go before the cameras knowing the lines, but I'm not totally sure of them. Do you follow what I mean? So that when they do come out of my mouth, they appear to be coming out of my mouth for the first time. I don't know what the system is. People at the American Academy asked me to come over and teach. I said, what am I going to teach? They said, the ILO system. I said, what is that? I have no way of defining it. All I know is I sit by myself, with myself, I work on the script, and it's a matter of repetition, constantly going over the entire script, interrelating with other characters, what other characters mean to me. And then I find, after making all the plans that I can, when I'm finally going before the cameras opposite the other actor, things change. And they all start all over again, and it's probably nothing that I've been rehearsing. But I like to go in there with that feeling that I'm not quite sure what all the lines are, so that it comes out not like rote, as I said before.
You started acting when you were in your mid-30s. Did you have any idea before that you were even interested in acting?
No, I gravitated toward acting, Terry, because I thought it might be, it's a communication media, and I was a fairly good talker, and I was fairly good with people, that maybe this would be the way to go. I was uneducated. I was in high school for about a half hour. I went in one door and out the other. I went to James Monroe. So I really had no education, no trade. So I felt that the obvious place to go after losing the union job would be into acting, never realizing how difficult that profession is. But I did it anyway. But I never thought I would be a failure. I always thought to some level I would be a success if I dedicated myself. And look what happened, you know.
I'm interested in your early life. Your father was a teamster and was on the road a lot.
Yeah, my father was not home. We had what could be perceived as a fatherless home.
Right.
Amanda would come home once a year, impregnate my mother, have a steak while we all ate macaronis and beans. But Mama managed to find a steak for him somehow, and he ate it. He ate it very proudly at the table while we ate macaroni and beans. But it was my mother who was solely responsible for the bringing up of 7 children.
I know you went to work when you were very young, but I think you also got involved in robberies when you were pretty young,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I did some crazy things. I had a fear, Terry, of being homeless, And I was early on. I don't know when I was put in my mind. I guess maybe if Mama decided to run off like Dad did, then the 7 kids would have been homeless. So I guess that was the germ of the idea in my mind. And as I grew up and I lost my union presidency job, and there was very little for me to, you know, I was making $190 here, then I was making nothing. I got frightened, and I thought I wasn't going to be able to keep a roof over the heads of my 4 children and my wife and myself. And I did things to compensate for that, and they were not armed robberies. They were not hitting people over the head. They were some maybe deserted buildings where there might be a safe. I did some silly, stupid things that I feel ashamed I did, and I hate to even talk about them in public because it sends out mixed signals. It's like the dope addict who says, look, you kids can don't start dope, you know, but he's telling a kid not to start dope when he was a dope addict and is now telling people he got off of it and he's a famous person, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly.
So I don't like to send out those messages, but the fact is that was my life. And I try to justify it by saying, you know, I was desperate, I thought we were going to be homeless, and that was the only way I can turn, because at that point in my life, it was pretty hard for me to have no money coming in and supporting a family of six, four children, my wife and I.
Did you make sure the statute of limitations was up before mentioning it publicly?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did. What a wise son of a gun I am, but I did. And, you know, I don't want you to think that it was like this was an ongoing thing forever. It was a thing that happened until the fear became so great in me that I said, I just can't do this, because what I would be doing is losing my family anyway if I did have to go in.
Mm-hmm.
And things, just as God wants, started to work out. See, I had the problem, I never wanted to borrow money from anyone. I wouldn't take money, I wouldn't ask, I wouldn't accept help from anyone. And the only help that I did accept was something that really set me off to stealing, and that was welfare. I didn't have the guts to go into the welfare office. My wife did. We were twice on welfare for 2 months. My wife stood in line, humiliated, right? And she came from a family that had money. She was humiliated, and she stood there. And I swore I would never do that again. So when we started to get destitute again, I refused to go back there. So the next thing that I did was decide to make money in another way. Sandy had no idea I did it. She thought I was hustling pool again, because I was an expert pool shooter, billiard shooter at the early time of my life. So I was telling Sandy lies as to where I was getting the rent money. There were times that I was 4 or 5 months behind in my rent, and I was afraid we were going to be homeless again. So I would go out and do something, and I'd break into cigarette machines, jukeboxes. I used to pay rent with quarters and nickels and dimes. It's crazy, and I'm ashamed to tell you this, Terry. And I don't want you to think any less of me for it, but I'll tell you, people do that, and we can be critical and should be critical, because no one should have to do that. But sometimes you get so desperate and you have no one to turn to ask the advice, and you go out and do it.
So what was the job that got you out of this?
Well, the acting started to come more and more, and I started bouncing in Roseland, and I took other bouncing jobs to supplement my earnings. Then, of course, the improvisation again. Then I began getting Broadway shows, acting jobs. Remember, the first acting jobs I got were on a stage, and they were off Broadway. They were so off, it was like in a Bronx somewhere. And they were paying very, very little money, if not any money at all, you know. They were like Equity Productions, 13 performances. The fortunate thing is a writer by the name of Louis LaRusso had written me 3 off-Broadway plays, and I gave back his audition, and each one of those plays I took to Broadway and starred in each of them.
My guest is Danny Aiello. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1992 interview with Danny Aiello. You know, we were talking about bluffing. The way you play Jack Ruby, he has to bluff his way through a lot of situations. I'm wondering, when you started to act, did you have to bluff your way into acting? Did you have to make it seem like you really knew what you were doing, even though you had no experience?
Terry, I never studied one day in my life as an actor. I never went to school. I was a man in a hurry. I started at 35. I felt schooling at this point to learn how to act is not what I need. If I don't know how to get up there and recreate things that I've had or have experienced on the street, then I have a serious problem. So I was a man in a hurry. The bluffing came where you had to lie, unfortunately, like most actors beginning do. They put on their resume, some phony resume, and because when you go in without a resume, you sit there with an agent. He said, what have you done? And you say, well, I haven't done anything yet. He said, well, I said, well, you get in what they call a catch-22. You can't get an agent unless you've done something. You can't get a job unless you have an agent. So what do you do? You know, somewhere along the line, someone has to believe that you can do it. Someone's got to be willing to give you that job.
What would you do at auditions to try to impress casting directors?
Well, auditions for me were horrific. I don't know that I've ever got a job in my life auditioning. I usually got my jobs talking head-to-head with the director. Right? He got to know about me, I got to know about him. But auditioning, even at this time, 7 years ago, I decided I will never audition again. I will never put the power in anyone's hands and tell them they haven't got it, I have got it. I am a firm believer, if I was a director, there is not an actor in the world that I couldn't cast for a movie if I was directing it by simply sitting opposite him and talking to him and having a conversation and being able to decide at that moment that I can work with this man and I can get what I want on the screen from this man. Reading of roles and trying to be someone at a cold reading or even a prepared reading is never what a good actor ends up doing anyway.
Because it's so contrived?
All baloney.
Yeah.
All you're doing is teaching the director and those other people who was his hangarounds want to learn about the character.
You know, one of your really big breakthrough roles was a Sal in Do the Right Thing. And I really loved you in that film. And I always felt watching that movie that Spike Lee probably saw the character as a blatant racist, but that you gave the character a depth and integrity. And I know you actually even wrote lines for the character to flesh the character out. But it was as if, to me, it was as if Spike Lee didn't notice that the character had changed by virtue of your interpretation of it. And so in the meantime, all the plot was proceeding as if you were this one-dimensional racist, when in fact the character you were playing was no longer that.
Yeah, if you pick up his original script, the original, you'll see that he was a one-note character. To me, he was what I would have called in the old days a token black in an all-white film. In this case, he could have been a token white in an all-black film. When I looked at it, I told Spike, I said, Spike, I said, this guy's a plantation owner. This guy's a boring character. Why is he there? Why is he in Bed-Stuy? Why has he got a pizzeria and in a totally black neighborhood? I said, he can be anywhere. So I defined in my own mind that he's there because that's where he wants to be. He likes the people. He enjoys the people he's working with. He saw them get older. He enjoys the fact that they love his food. He's that kind of a simple guy, and it was because of that, I think, that made the character a more sympathetic character, and they're a multi-dimensional character, as opposed to a simple out-and-out racist. Now, you may define in your own mind or come to the conclusion that Sal is a racist, but it's not obvious.
But do you think that Spike Lee maybe didn't even notice how the character was changing? In other words, I always felt that the movie proceeded, the plot proceeded as if some of the people were acting to you like you were this just one-note racist, which the character no longer was.
Well, that may be the ability to people to either respond as actors or not be able to respond to what it is they're hearing. You know what I mean? With Spike, I have to give him this. Before I agreed to do this, I said I wanted to make some changes. He said, anything you want to do to make it better. That's what Spike said. And he went with the program as we were going. See, there was one part of the film at the end where it bothered me that Spike's character, Mookie, said to Sal, my character, what are you arguing about after the place was burned? Are you going to get your money back on insurance? I was infuriated by that remark because you cannot, as a store owner, as a business owner in Bed-Stuy, get insurance. So I said, this is a joke. Why are you saying that? I said, I want to come back. Well, what are you kidding? I couldn't get earthquake insurance in this neighborhood. He didn't want that line in. So I had to write this other line. This isn't about money. This is about I built this place with my bare hands. Do you remember that line? So he compromised somewhat. He didn't want me to say I couldn't get earthquake insurance in this neighborhood. But he did permit me to say, this isn't about money. This is about I built this place with my bare hands. Anything anyone ever tells me could never make me believe that Sal was an out-and-out racist. What Sal is a realist. If a man, forgive my language, or anyone who may be offended, looks at Sal and calls him a guinea, Sal will in kind come back and call you a nigger, a spick, a mick, a kite. Do you follow what I'm saying? He would go to the core of trying to hurt that person as that person just tried to hurt him. That's the honesty of Sal.
Danny Aiello, recorded in 1992. He plays a cop turned private eye in the new TV series Della Ventura, which premieres Tuesday on CBS. Coming up, previously unreleased Elvis. This is Fresh Air. We began this week with an interview with Sam Phillips, who discovered Elvis Presley and produced Elvis's first recordings. We end the week with a review of RCA's recently released collection, Elvis Presley Platinum. It's packed with stuff we've never heard before from every stage of the King's career, but after listening to it, rock historian Ed Ward wonders if we'll know him any better as a result.
Singing sensation all over the country. Elvis Presley.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Cry all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine. Well, they said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie. Yeah, they said you were high class.
There's no doubt about it. Even though he's been dead 20 years, Elvis lives. A great deal of this can be laid to the fact that his record company, RCA, has astutely marketed his recorded works, constantly repackaging and reshuffling them so that there's always something new for the faithful. Now they've announced they're not going to release any more until the turn of the century, and they've left us with a 4-CD collection called Elvis Presley Platinum, A Life in Music. On the face of it, it looks pretty exciting. 100 tracks, 77 of which have never been released, including private tapes, excerpts from TV performances, and outtakes from recording sessions. But really, what do we have here? The set starts out with one of the recordings he made at Sam Phillips' private recording service, done, the liner notes speculate, to remind Sam of his existence.
If you find someone new, who means more than me to you, I'll never stand in your way. If you feel we must part, don't let pity rule your heart. I'll never stand in your way.
His strategy worked, of course, but I'll never stand in your way is pretty weak, and today is just another curiosity. I mean, does this sound like the boy with the Negro sound and feel that Sam was looking for? As we all know, Sam knew what he was doing, though, and we're provided with an outtake from that historic first session. Unfortunately, it's the wrong one.
Well, that's all right, Mama. Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama.
Interesting as it is to hear guitarist Scotty Moore flub some notes, the real gem from this session is the first take of Blue Moon of Kentucky, where Sam comes out of the control room, mind blown by what he's heard, and tells him, "That's a pop song now, little Vi, that's different." Bootleggers have had this track for years. why isn't it here? The fact is, Elvis usually had a real good idea what he was going to do when he stepped up to the studio microphone, despite his flair for winging it on stage. Very few of the outtakes here give us any deeper understanding of his artistic growth, at least partially because, at first, nobody wanted to spend valuable studio time on something as ephemeral as rock and roll. Where the revelations come from in this collection is from private tapes, and some of these are strange revelations indeed. This boogie-woogie version of I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen is part of a medley of sentimental songs recorded in Bad Nauheim, Germany, where he was stationed in the army, by Freddie Beanstock, the music publisher who fed him his material. And it's this very material, overseen by Elvis's manager, Tom Parker, which lurks over most of this collection. Do we need an alternate take of Bossa Nova Baby? I don't, although I have to admit that the worst of the post-Army stuff didn't make the cut here, so that alternate take of You Can't Rumba in a Sports Car, if it exists, is missing. The 1968 TV comeback special was a brief revival of Elvis's rocker, and part of its appeal was the segment where he sat around with some musicians and just jammed. The idea for this came to producer Steve Binder when he heard Elvis and some friends unwinding after a rehearsal, some of which is captured here.
See my baby.
This kind of tape makes you wish there was more private Elvis to hear, because other rehearsal tapes here from 1970 show that he was at his best working with his musician friends.
And oh, the landlord rang my front door bell. She let it ring for a long, long spell. Went to the window, peeped through the blind. I asked him to tell me what was wrong.
In the end, though, the progress of the comeback special was erased by more touring, more Vegas, and more personal turmoil. Elvis Presley Platinum rightly turns the spotlight on Elvis the Rock and Roller, but there's just no getting away from the collection's final musical selection, Fat Elvis gasping his way through My Way to a cornball climax. Fanatics like me will need this collection, but don't come looking for insight. I'm afraid that left the building with Elvis.
Ed Ward writes about music from his home in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Audrey Bentham, and Fred Snyder. Tina Brock is our administrative assistant this week. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life this full, I traveled each and every byway, oh, and more, much more than this. I did it my had a few, but then again, too few to mention.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of The Aryan Christ, The Secret Life of Carl Jung by Richard Knoll. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our new poet laureate, Robert Pinsky, reads some of his own poems and some of his favorites by other poets. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.